I'm very pleased to present to you our final speaker today, Rebecca Maynard. Dr. Maynard is a trustee professor of education, social policy, and communication in the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania. Previously, she has served the well-respected Mathematical Policy Research Incorporated as a senior vice president and director of Princeton Research. She's also served as a consultant to the General Accounting Office, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the United States Department of Health and Human Services. She served on numerous committees, advisory panels. I'm going to name just a couple: the National Academy of Sciences panel on child care policy, and the Jobs Program Implementation Study, as well as the National Dropout Demonstration Assistance Program. This is the first time I met her today, and she's so young. You know, after I read this resume, I was expecting someone older. She's published on a variety of topics in a range of journals and books, and most important for our purposes today is that she's offered studies on the supported work programs for teen parents. And her involvement in the Teenage Parent Welfare Demonstration Program may be especially interesting to states because participation was mandated and it's voluntary in many of the other demonstration programs. Now, by the time I got to Rebecca's talk, I was running out of visuals. The focus of her talk today is teenage parents, and as you know, she's written one section of the briefing report, and I took one fact from her paper. Now, this apple represents all welfare recipients. What proportion do you think are current or former teenage parents? What proportion do you think of all welfare recipients are current or former teenage parents? Did I hear it? 30? 42? Half. Actually, it's about half. So, Professor Maynard's comments today are going to talk about half of the welfare population, which is teenage parents. And so her topic today is Welfare Reform in Teenage Childbearing, Lessons from a Decade of Research.
Thank you. My anxiety level has been very high since I didn't know what we were going to do with the knife and the apple, but I did know. So I'm relieved. I'm also really pleased to be back in Madison. I spent 4 years here back in the heyday of the Institute for Research on Poverty and one of the earlier generations of welfare reform when we were doing negative income tax experiments. Why focus on teens? Well, part of my thunder is gone. It's half of the welfare population. But there's some other reasons that the lessons from experiences with teenage parents on welfare are extremely important in your thinking about welfare reform options. One reason is this problem is getting worse. The incidence of teenage childbearing is rising again. We had a period of decline followed by a period of stability. The incidence is on the rise. An increasing proportion, now over 70% of the teens who are giving birth are giving birth out of wedlock. And there's a very, very high rate of welfare dependency among teens, particularly those who are giving birth out of wedlock. 77% of the teens who give birth out of wedlock are expected to be on welfare within 5 years, most of them relatively soon after giving birth. So this is something that is a big part of the problem today. It is projected to be a bigger part of the problem in the future. Another reason to focus on the teens is we have better information about the potential of some welfare reform options from studies that have been done with the teen parent population than with comparable adult populations, simply because we've tried some more innovative options with this population. And I'll get to how I think the results for teens may generalize to what you might think about doing with adults. I'm going to try to build up to leaving you with six major conclusions from the work that I have done over the past 10 years with welfare reform and teen parents. The first one is that employment is the only route out of poverty for the vast majority of welfare recipients, teen parents in particular, but basically all of them. The second is that there's a very high incidence of second and subsequent births among welfare recipients, particularly teen welfare recipients, that impede employment prospects. Having one child is a problem. It impedes your prospects. Having two or more children really reduces the probability that you are going to make the transition to economic self-sufficiency. And compounding this is a parenthetical under this, traditional ways of delivering family planning services are not effective in reducing the incidence of repeat pregnancy. The third point I want to leave you with is that culture change in the welfare system is really necessary if we're going to reduce the dependency problem. I want to underscore that point. It fits in with what Tom was talking about earlier. But the good news is that it really is possible to change the culture. The program I'm going to talk about in a few minutes will illustrate how we did change the culture and how I think we could move forward and have a bigger culture change if we just rethought and redefined the welfare system somewhat. The fourth point I want to leave you with is that programs with truly mandatory participation requirements, I use the word mandatory with some caution, but that's the current rhetoric, so I will use that term. The truly mandatory participation requirements need not be punitive, and they need not be harmful to children. Programs that hold case managers accountable for addressing clients' needs will lead to increased levels of support for the welfare recipients and their children, and moreover, the welfare recipients who are subject to these mandates with a helping hand of a case manager do not resent it. So this need not be punitive if it's administered with a non-punitive spirit. The fifth point I want to build up to is traditional approaches to second chance education and training programs are marginally effective at best. We need to rethink how we define and deliver these kinds of services, and Chris gave you a preview of some of the results there. And the final point is that supportive services such as child care and transportation are really essential. You do have to think about them, you do have to budget for them, but every state, every county, every federal program that is budgeted for these services has overestimated the true cost of them, and it holds people back from doing the right thing. These services are not as costly as people imagine them to be, simply because there's a lot of creativity in the community in terms of how people will manage their lives when faced with the right push and pull to start participating in their own support and building towards self-sufficiency. So there's my thunder. These conclusions are based in large part on experiences that I had in the design and oversight and evaluation of a large-scale field test of what I characterize quite simplistically as a truly mandatory version of a jobs, big JLBS program targeted at teenage parents who were coming onto the rolls for the first time. Somebody asked the question about programs for infants. We were dealing with teenage parents with infants. They got 6 weeks medical leave, and then they were mandatory in our program. So the results that I'm going to be talking about do apply to young mothers with infants. And I've also drawn on a sizable body of complementary demonstration and evaluation research, so sometimes I'm extrapolating a little bit beyond the narrow perspective of this one large-scale demonstration. Let me talk a little bit about this demonstration. In the late 1980s, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services launched a program we call the Teenage Parent Welfare Demonstration to test a mandatory jobs-type program. This is before the Family Support Act. But essentially, the programs provided extensive case management and support services, childcare, transportation, counseling, workshops, some on-site education and training activities. The programs were mandatory. Teenage parents on welfare had to come into these programs. They had to participate actively in some activity that was judged by the case managers to be moving on a path towards self-sufficiency. Nominally, it was 30 hours of school, work, or job training. In practice, it was serious attention to something that was either one of those three activities or something preparatory to one of those three activities. So the caseworkers did a nice job of bending the rules to be reasonable but faithful to the spirit of the federal mandate. The programs operated, we saturated the cities of Camden and Newark, New Jersey, and we ran a program of about 2,500 young mothers on the whole south side of Chicago. So we were running programs at scale. Okay, these programs were modest in cost with the notion that we wanted to test something that might be applicable to national or state policy. So the average cost of these programs was $166 per case month, which is not very much. This is on top of AFTC benefits. This is an increment. Finally, the programs offered no exemptions or deferrals. Okay? Everybody was in the program. Case managers were accountable for developing service plans, for monitoring participation, and for invoking sanctions if young mothers failed to participate in some activity that was deemed to be consistent with the mandate. And in fact, the sanction policy was invoked a lot during this demonstration, with some very positive results, which I will get to. We've now analyzed data for the first 3 years following enrollment in the demonstration project, are in the process of collecting data for 6 years following enrollment in the demonstration, including doing extensive assessments of the children who are now entering preschool, kindergarten, first grade. So in another year or two, we will have a lot more information about the children. But the findings to date, would you put up the first slide? The overall participation in this program was very high. We had basically 90% of the young mothers coming onto welfare for the first time with a child participated in this program. The other 10% either left, this is the final column, either left welfare relatively soon after we called them into the program or were sanctioned for non-compliance. Okay, most of those who did not come into the program, they fell into two camps. They didn't need welfare, so there was a smoke-out effect, or they needed welfare but for a very short period of time, and so they transitioned off very quickly. So we essentially saturated the population. We did get people in. What I want to point out to you is the black bar at the bottom. Okay, roughly 33% of these young mothers came in. This was, if you just sort of tell them this is a requirement, okay? We needed to use the sanction policy to get from 33% to 89% of the population. It was very important to keep on these kids' cases and to say, you need to do this. If you don't do this, the check goes down. So, if you're going to get participation in a program like this, you can't just say, I've got a great program, great services, come on in, you have to come. You need to go reach out to these kids. A lot of the kids who don't come in are not coming in because they're lazy, because they're unmotivated. They're coming in because they're scared, because they don't believe it. Nobody's ever meant it before when they told them they had to do something. There's a variety of reasons. All of the initial resistance dissipated once the kids got in the program. Nobody in the long run resented this program and resented the mandates of the program because of the way the mandates were applied. Second set of findings from this was that we've had statistically significant but modest effects, I would say, in all of our major outcomes we were attempting to achieve. We increased school enrollment, we increased participation in job training, we increased employment and earnings, and we did this in all three cities. This is a first, I think, in social science demonstrations to have consistent results in three replications of a project. Could you put up the second figure? This figure, this happens to be participation in out-of-home activities, school work or training overall. This is a time trend. You just see moving from initial period of time when the young mothers came into the program to 2 years later. The top line is the path for the individuals who were subject to the mandate. The bottom line is a comparable group, randomly selected, who were under the standard welfare rules. You would see exactly a similar pattern if I put up school participation, job training participation, or employment. Okay. Overall, that's a 28% increase in the proportion of the time that these young mothers were engaged in activity. So it's a significant difference. It's not huge. We don't have most of them actively engaged in one of these three activities all the time because, as Tom and Kristen have pointed out, this population has all kinds of problems, and the problems aren't stable. The other thing I want to emphasize is you can't type an AFTC recipient at one point in time and expect to get the same typology if you go in 3 months later, 6 months later, 9 months later. A child who is in a teen who is in a stable environment, supportive environment, doing fine today, may be in chaos and really big trouble tomorrow. You need to be prepared for that. To put up the next graph just briefly, this illustrates the same outcome but looking across the sites, and I wanted to just show you that the same pattern, different levels, but the same pattern of results occurred across all three of the projects. And I think this is important because it gives us some greater confidence that it was the program design and not just doing something. It was something about the consistency of the overall program design, which was very simple. It was welfare is a reciprocal obligation program now. You, the welfare recipient, have to engage in some activity that's forward-moving. We, the welfare system, have to work with you to identify the impediments to forward progress and to help you overcome these impediments. Let me say, too, that we did also reduce welfare dependency by small amounts, but as Kristen said, we did not have impacts on the overall poverty rate because of the offsetting earnings going up, welfare going down. That is a problem that could be changed by the welfare rules and the tax rates we impose on earnings. We could get these two things going together, but we didn't in this demonstration. We had significantly larger, much, much larger effects for Hispanics than for blacks, so the results are positive and significant for both groups. One of the reasons we think, we hypothesize we have the stronger effects for Hispanics is there's very strong pulls in a lot of, especially in the teen parent families among the males in these young women's lives, tend to resent and be feel threatened by the young mothers going to school or work or training. And so there's a lot of pulling them, you know, not wanting them to engage in these activities. What happened as a result of the mandates was welfare took the heat. It was now your benefits were the young mother's benefits were going to go down by $160 a month if she didn't comply with this requirement that the boyfriend or the father of the child thought was inappropriate. So in some sense, this was the young mother didn't resent going having to go back to school or get a job. She just didn't know how to break this barrier that was being put up for her. I said at the outset that employment is the key to escaping poverty. You put up the next chart here. This is the not looking at different program groups, but just overall. Look at the second set of bars. That is the poverty rate for those who are employed and not employed. The black bar, the 24% of those who are employed and in poverty, 97% of those young teen mothers on welfare who were not employed are in poverty. This is 2 years after they came into our sample. We see differences in the poverty rate for those who have a repeat pregnancy versus those who don't. We see some difference for those who get married and those who don't, but those differences are small in comparison to the impact of employment. Employment is the root out of poverty and off welfare. In fact, the young mothers in our sample don't look to marriage as a solution. They don't find comfort in the institution of marriage. They have not seen positive role models. In the briefing document, you'll see some actual quotes that you've only got one or two quotes in there, but I can tell you I have a stack of them that are just like that. That is a common resounding theme. These young mothers do not look to marriage as something that is going to solve their problem. On the more pessimistic side here, these reforms, all three sites offered family planning services. We made sure that the kids had funding for family planning. We assisted them in family planning. Most of them used contraception. Most of them got pregnant again. We had no impact on the repeat pregnancy rate. The reason is not what is commonly touted. It's not going for the extra $60 a month. The reason is these lives are so disorganized that even though they know about contraception, they're using contraception, they can't and don't use it effectively and consistently for a variety of reasons. One reason is they don't work on 24-hour clocks, so taking a pill every morning is not something they can really adapt to. the boyfriends interfere. They have attitudes about contraception, the macho thing that comes into play. So there are lots of reasons that they don't follow through on this. We have not cracked this one yet. We need to keep working on it. Corroborating evidence from other demonstrations really, I think, brings us to some generalizations. We've looked at a number of programs that are voluntary programs, similar in design, but don't have the mandate. The New Chance program that Kristen mentioned before cost about five times as much per participant as this program. With the voluntary program, it reached probably 10% or less of the teen parent population. It had actually increased the pregnancy rate, had significant negative impacts on earnings, did keep kids in school. But really, we didn't get anything for the extra dollars in that program. There are new results out from the LEAP program in Ohio that suggest that is a mandatory program, like this program, except school is the only activity. That program has results that parallel these results on schooling. They haven't measured the earnings results. But the other interesting finding is they have an enriched program where they've lavished the kids with more support services. Those extra services didn't change the basic results. Okay, so that's going to be an interesting set of results when it gets more, they get more widely distributed. The common themes here are that all of the programs for teen parents face major challenges getting young mothers to participate, and only the programs with welfare-linked participation requirements accompanied by financial sanctions have really succeeded in reaching large portions of the population. Okay, so if you really want to reach these kids, you have to have an incentive for them to participate in your program and participate consistently. This New Chance program, which the average cost was $9,000 a year they spent on these kids, most of the kids stayed in the program less than 6 months. Okay, they had no limits on how long they could stay in. The second point here is that all of the impacts of the interventions on human capital development, employment, and fertility have been modest at best. And so what we really need to do is to continue to refine our models. We need to worry about the services we're putting the kids in. One of the major problems we faced in our program was that although we worked hard to get the kids into school and job training, the programs we were putting them in, we knew were not quality programs. We knew they were not welcome back in the public schools. We knew the public schools were not really challenging the young mothers and dealing with their other needs as best they could. We didn't have, in this demonstration, the capacity to actually change those other institutions in major ways. But we could work on those things and boost our results through that network. Third is just to underscore the fact that none of the employment or welfare-focused programs succeeded in helping the young mothers control their fertility. We do have two models, two demonstration projects that have succeeded here. They're both medical models. Where they basically sent nurse home visitors out into the mother's home and worked with them on a weekly or biweekly basis for the first year to 2 years after the mothers give birth. And these programs have had quite dramatic success in the repeat pregnancy. And I scratch my head and I've talked to the people who have run those programs and the people who have run the more welfare-based programs. And we have a new hunch about this, which is, if you think about the difference between a social worker or an income maintenance worker and a doctor or a nurse, one of the things is a doctor or a nurse says do it. They say take this pill and do it every day. That's what you have to do. They're not at all averse to passing judgment and saying this is right, this is wrong. And they stay in the face. Okay? The doctor says they stay in your face and they remind you constantly and they help you over. If you go to the doctor and you say, oh, you know, I'm gaining weight with these pills, well, the doctor's going to either assure you that that's really not a big deal and the benefits of that pill is going to outweigh this little weight gain, or, you know, substitute something else for this. What happens, I think, in many of our, I know in our program, was we thought it was enough to give them access, to open the doors, to empower them to do this if they wanted to do it. It wasn't enough. Our young mothers did not want more children. They adamantly did not want more children. They did not plan for more children. And they were at least doing something to try to prevent this. But that's not enough. They really need something stronger. We are about to try blending these two models and try home visiting overlaid on this mandatory welfare program. We're in the field starting next month with a 5-site demonstration of this intervention. Let me just stop there and take questions.
Yeah. You said the key to getting out of poverty, of course, is employment. Do you have examples of research indications that show government business partnership to facilitate that to occur?
The question is, do we have examples of government-business partnerships to facilitate the transition of welfare recipients from dependency to employment? Yes, I think we do have some examples of that. I think some of the more successful job training programs, and there are a few of them, the two that I would highlight for you is this a program called the TET program, Center for Employment Training Program, in San Jose, California. It's actually a syndicated program. They have programs throughout mostly the West, and they are now starting to implement programs elsewhere. These are not the kinds of programs that America Works generates. This is a business enterprise. It's a training vendor. Brings in, doesn't have to be welfare recipients, but they bring in disadvantaged individuals with an open entry, open exit policy, and they train, which means basically they're not doing the kind of pre-screening for basic skills that JTPA does. They will take people with low basic skills. They will take people with language minority. What they do is they bring the individual in. They have jobs and employer links lined up, so they know that they're going to train 10 people for packaging in a big warehousing plant. They bring the people in. They have actually an array of training options that individuals can go in. They let the workers try out the options in simulated settings. They pick a vocation. Then they train you for that specific job, and they remediate your basic skills as necessary for that job, as distinct from saying, okay, we're going to get you reading up to 10th grade, then we'll worry about teaching you what you need to know to do this warehousing job, or whatever the job happens to be. Those programs have been quite successful. They've been successful with welfare recipients, with non-welfare recipients, with males. Very few programs have been successful with males, young males. And the other example I think we look within the welfare system is probably the Riverside GAIN program, which is distinguished from all of the other GAIN programs, I think, in one dimension, and that is that it's very, very serious about jobs. I think, in fact, your Kenosha program may be similar in concept. We've had some three-way panels on this, and I know less about that because of the Kenosha program, because it hasn't been researched as much, but basically, programs where the trainers are linking with the employers and basically working as a go-between between welfare and employers, and they're basically making their money through the training contract, but they've got jobs at the other end.
How are they financed?
They're financed through some of them have JTPA contracts and just have set themselves up to take the risks on this. Some of them have jobs contracts. CET is basically takes money from a lot of different places and blends the resources. They participate a lot in demonstration projects as well. Yeah.
My question has to do with the options determining unintended pregnancy. Middle-income teenagers also get pregnant and maybe they exercise that option. I think you said the majority of these teens did not intend to get pregnant. Tell me about
the abortion option is exercised. Okay, the question is how is the abortion option exercised among the welfare dependent teenage parents? It's exercised at a much lower rate than it is for middle class parents. Most of the teens, or I think it's about half of the teens, have had abortions for previous pregnancies before they give birth. But if they get pregnant again, the vast majority of them carry the babies to term. They do not entertain abortion after the first birth. I think, Kristen knows this better than I think this is common. After you've had one baby, you're less likely to have an abortion the second time around. We also, in this demonstration, were under the gag rule, and were not allowed to, at least when anybody from the federal government was anywhere near, utter the word abortion. I happen to know that it got uttered, abortion is not, it's sort of like the converse of marriage is not something these young girls do. Abortion is not something that is that they do. Having another baby, if it happens, it happens. It's sort of the attitude among most of them. Yes.
I understand that there's a difference in the success rate between the girls who entered as dropouts and those who entered into high school education. Can you talk about that?
The question is, when I talked about the difference in the success rate for those who entered as dropouts and those who entered with a high school education. That difference, I think, has been exaggerated in some of the citations of this research. You have to understand what the rules of the game in this demonstration were. You had to do something, schoolwork or training. We did not prioritize those activities for the young mother except in a counseling format. As far as the architects of this demonstration were concerned, if a young mother had dropped out of school, didn't want to return to school, the fact that I thought she should return to school didn't matter. If she said, I really want to get a job, we accepted that. We might have said to her, you know, you ought to think about this. But we gave some latitude there. In this demonstration, what we found is that those who had not completed school had higher rates, they had bigger impacts on school completion and school attendance. Those who had already completed school tended to be the beneficiaries of the employment effects. And the job training effects also were disproportionately enjoyed by those who had high school degrees already. That is strictly because if you do not have a high school diploma, you are restricted for most of the JCPA-funded training programs in these sites and nationally. So that was almost definitional. We didn't have our own training money, and if you didn't have the high school diploma, you didn't have the option of getting into training. So as it turns out, basically, the results were sort of as you would have expected. We had bigger education results for those who hadn't yet completed high school, bigger employment results for those who had completed high school. We haven't yet, until we get the six-year follow-up, won't know what happened to those who were in schooling during the first period, and did they then go on and get more training. Does that, okay.
Yeah, I have a question. You talked about changing culture behaviors.
Yes.
What did you do as a result of the organization to try to address some of the cultural differences of those populations that you dealt with? You talked a little bit about the Hispanic culture and how their culture is set up with involving males and the development of trust with other outside organizations. Mm-hmm. And you really didn't, you just said that they were able to blame your system or your program for the fact that the women were involved in training. And that just sort of concerned me somewhat, because it didn't seem like that component to address the culture and the work within the system to change the attitude to care. But more or less, this is what you get, and this is what you don't get. You know,
okay.
I guess I just wanted to know more about that. And did you have staff that work with people of color involved in that?
Yes. The question is, what do we do about the cultural issues and the differences in the cultures? Most of the staff who were actually working in the program level, they came from the community. They came from the local welfare agencies. My involvement was in the design, the oversight, and the evaluation of this. These programs were run by the welfare agencies, and they had that blend. The staff pretty well reflected the welfare population in terms of gender and race, ethnicity. I probably misled you a little bit I presented that result a little baldly, but this did not become a confrontational issue with the young men. It's just a little, the culture is a little bit like you know, the girls would come in and say, well, you know, he's really on my case because he thinks I'm going to be a smarty pants and, you know, I'm going to leave him if I get this job. That's what's pulling them out. It's not like it's a, you know, so there's a little pull out of not going to school, not getting a job. And it was really just, it just worked when the caseworkers said, you know, I understand. But basically, the caseworkers were very sympathetic. The big culture change in this program was the caseworkers. The caseworkers changed their attitudes because, not because they were any better or worse people, but because we changed their job. We no longer said we're looking at whether or not you fill out these forms right. We're looking at whether or not you keep the kids moving in a forward direction, whether or not you identify the problems when they occur, and you respond to them. So all of a sudden we said to the caseworkers, the name of the game for you is to avoid a sanction, to keep the kids engaged, to deal with their problems. And that's what the caseworkers did. And they initially, this is a, you know, their initial reaction to the sanctions was they weren't going to do it. And they, for 2 months, in each of the sites, they refused to do it. And then the federal government came in and said, you've got our money, you have to do it this way. The end of the demonstration, I asked all the caseworkers what they thought about sanctions. If this was their choice, would they have a mandatory or voluntary program? What do you think they said?
Mandatory.
And when I said why, they said it's the best tool we've got. So they adapted, they adopted this as their, basically their lever with the kids to get their attention, to bring them in. And they could say, well, look, I don't want to do this. I don't want to touch a grant. You need to tell me what's going on. We need to solve this together. And that's how the program, that's how the culture changed. This became a partnership between the kids and the caseworkers to solve the problem, to maximize the welfare of the child, both of the teen and her family, both at the time they were in the program and projecting forward. I hope that gives you a better sense of how...
Yeah, it does.
And
also, she said, what happens to the mail? How do we bring
it to the mail? Okay, what happened to the mail? Yeah, let me say, in this demonstration, there's a whole set of things we tried to do with the mail that I didn't get into. We had a child support enforcement component to the demonstration, which child support fought us on for a long time. We did try to engage the males in the programs, all the sites trying to get males involved. It's a much more complicated endeavor than any of us thought. We were all pretty naive. One of the problems, just to, you know, at the extreme, we had a male, we were proud, we succeeded in getting him in. The problem was, he had 3 girls in the program, in the room, pregnant. You know, so the, I mean, that's just one of the, some of the men, just only about 20% of these men are still consistently involved with these young women. Okay, only 30% of the men are supporting these children in any way. Okay, and another third have contact but aren't really providing support. And a third are just gone. Okay, gone. 15% of the men who fathered the children of our sample were dead or in jail an average of 28 months later. That just, you know, blows you away. 15%.
Now, if any of you leave early, I'm asking for evaluation. I'm going to ask the other 2 panelists to join us up front, and you can ask questions of any of the panelists. Yes.
Question for the last presenter. You talked about the importance of sanctions in conjunction with the program that you're running. Would sanctions, financial sanctions, have an impact if they were by themselves on an issue like fertility?
Financial sanctions are, no. I mean, I don't have hard evidence because we didn't test that. The question is, would financial sanctions alone, without the other aspects of the program, have an impact on fertility? If you read the qualitative research report that is part of our evaluation study, which you don't have, but you have some quotes from it in the document, the reasons these young mothers were getting pregnant was not about money. This was about impulse, sexual desire, need for approval and wanting relationships, and not being an effective contraceptor. It was really the issue of I'm stepping into opinion with a lot of hard evidence behind me, but not you know, the real scientific evidence that we have in other aspects of the study. But the $60 a month these young mothers would get doesn't really, you know, doesn't really enter that calculus. I live in New Jersey. We have FedRed, and the research that's hitting the papers, I can tell you, is seriously flawed research. We have a decline in the pregnancy rate among welfare recipients across the state. This is not confined to the FedRed program. So,
yes, Beth.
Yes, I have a question. Did these young mothers have any clearly held feelings about the responsibilities and the rights of the fathers of children?
And who are you addressing that to?
Gillespie.
Dr. Maynard, did these young mothers have any feelings toward the fathers of their children?
Yes, as far as the rights and their responsibilities.
The rights and responsibilities of the fathers of their children.
Well, they did. They were highly variable in terms of what they felt about this. Many of the young mothers did not want these men around, and we need to realize that there are lots of non what we think of as standard relationships out there. So many of them didn't want the fathers around. This was sort of a relationship that had soured long ago, and therefore they would go to any length to not have these men have access to their children. Therefore, they didn't want any money from them. They didn't want any support from them. They didn't want the fathers to see the child. Wasn't necessarily a rational perspective on did they think they had rights or not. This was they would mix up those. There are others who, who do very clearly want the baby to have a father. At the other extreme, they recognize that the young man is the father of the child and has rights and want the visitation, want the support. I would say that most of them fall in a gray area in the middle where. Drug abuse or spousal abuse. And let me tell you, the mandates were very important in identifying some of these problems. One of the things a teen mother or any welfare mother will do if she's getting, or many of them, if they're getting abused, is they don't show. You don't see it until the bruises are healed. Because of the mandatory nature of the program, our caseworkers had an obligation to look into cases that were not attending school or showing up at work or whatever. So we were identifying more of those cases. They got handled two ways. I mean, they obviously followed state protocol in terms of how suspected or identified cases were handled. They also got handled with a lot more counseling and hand-holding from the program staff, bringing in extra counseling and support resources to deal with that. Individuals who had drug abuse problems, I would say the fraction that had serious drug abuse problems in our population was not huge. They were there. The way they were, the casual users is of course much higher, but the way that was handled was if drug abuse was interfering with your participation in your, whatever your self-sufficiency oriented activities were, you were referred to or mandated to treatment, and again supported by your case manager and the counselors at the program staff. So I guess what we had is we had better diagnostic services than is typically available in the welfare system, and we had the capacity to do some supportive follow-up. We did not have extensive funding for either of those. So basically what we did is supplement the current system.
Well, did they show what you mandated?
Did the young mothers show when you mandated it for drug treatment? Most of them did eventually. The sanctions were very powerful. We sanctioned a third of the, we issued warnings to over two-thirds of the cases at one or more times during the period of participation in the program, and sanctioned a third of them. Basically, the sanctions were very powerful. If they didn't come on their own, once you issue the sanction, they do come. Okay, they can't live on the reduced check. So, yeah, you have a question?
I have two questions. One, again, focuses on the domestic violence population. And I think a comment that was real concerning that because of the consumption of many relatives, alcohol, the whole chaos of
So the question.
Let's do the question first. Okay, so you're saying that is the mandatory nature of the program really intensify the seriousness of the domestic abuse problem?
That being one, and the concerns of safety, in terms of job issues, women's jobs,
and also concerns of safety if the mothers are mandated to participate in a job education program.
I think this is an area where in our program, and I would hope in any similar type of program, there needs to be flexibility and creativity in how you deal with the issue. The question that we would put to the caseworkers in the program is, if a young mother is being abused, is the right thing to do to ignore her and to say, well, you're being abused, so you know we don't have to do anything about getting your life together and getting you on the right track? So if we say the answer to that is no, we do have to do something about this. We have to. Then the question is, what do we do? What can we do given these circumstances? And then you've got to be more creative. And this is a more challenging task. And it may be, in some cases, what we had to do is be in creativity and how you deal with the issue. The question that we would put to the caseworkers in the program is, if a young mother is being abused, is the right thing to do to ignore her and to say, well, you're being abused, so you know we don't have to do anything about getting your life together and getting you on the right track? So if we say the answer to that is no, we do have to do something about this. We have to. Then the question is, what do we do? What can we do given these circumstances? And then you've got to be more creative. And this is a more challenging task. And it may be, in some cases, what we had to do was to get people relocated more quickly. In some cases, we had to deal with court orders on the men, and we could facilitate that so that they were prevented from being near the young mother. In some cases, you need a time out. You know, you may need to sort of say, okay, well, for the next, I don't know how long, 3 weeks, 2 weeks, whatever, while we get this settled, I'm going to sort of let you slide on your requirements. That's okay. So the real issue here is, I think you get into trouble if you sort of take the bureaucratic approach and say, well, it's 20 hours a week, it's 19, too bad the check is cut, instead of saying, well, you've got a special circumstance this week, but it's not okay to not work on that problem. Okay, so I think that's where the culture change comes. Be flexible, but be consistent in your goals and objectives and requirements. The clarity here is, the kids, the teens, if it's not teens, the welfare recipients have to do something. They have to be moving ahead. They have to be working to try to get on the right path if they want you to support them through welfare. And you're there to help them. This is a partnership.
Let me just add something. Actually, when Shannon and Karen and I were talking about setting this up, we wanted to bring in a speaker to talk about males, young males. That would have been a good complement to this, but we didn't think we had enough time. In fact, males are the lost group in all this discussion. They are marginalized. They are the ones who have lost the most in real earnings over the last two decades. They're not good marriage partners, et cetera, et cetera. You're doing some things in Wisconsin, I think, too. Bring males into the picture, but basically they are ignored. I think that's really too bad. When we talk about going from like one generation model to two generation model, which essentially means going from a one generation model that just focus on the mother or just focus on the child, two generation model would be focusing on both the mother and the child together as a component. Then we keep saying, people tell us that's not enough. You have to go to three generation model, which oftentimes means that the mother, daughter, and the daughter's child. But it also might mean this partner who's out there in the world and whom we have a hell of a time bringing into the picture, but perhaps we ought to think about bringing them into the picture in more than just a paycheck way.
I think I'm going to have to cut it off. I promised to stop here at 10.